Hello, I'm Damien Coleridge. Welcome to an encounter with memory. Indeed, an encounter with dangerous memories.
Inside the Hall of Memory at the Australian War Memorial in Canberra. The centre of the memorial. Their stained glass windows depicting the personal qualities of Australian servicemen and women.
Australia remembers, yes, but what do we remember? Officially, the end of a great war in mid-century. Unofficially, Australians are remembering all sorts of things, year in, year out. Memories of Europe, Asia, Africa, all that goes to make up Australia. Every Sunday, to take but one example, many Christians eat the bread and drink the wine in memory of me, in memory of Jesus. And it's been said that Christian belief depends entirely on what J.B. Metz once called a dangerous memory. Perhaps all religions depend entirely on a dangerous memory. Dangerous memory, feminist theology through story, was the theme of a recent conference. And that conference made the connection between dangerous memories and the telling of stories. Sarah Maitland, novelist and theologian, spoke at the Dangerous Memory Conference.
I'm not really a theologian in the ordinary sense of the word. I'm not an academically qualified theologian. I'm a theologian in the amateur sense, that is to say, the sense of being a lover. And lovers have special privileges, I think. I would claim for myself a special privilege in relation to theology just by not being a professional, but being an amateur theologian. What I am professionally is a writer of stories. And I suppose I want to write stories about the divine. I want to find ways of doing that, and particularly a divine which doesn't merely not exclude, but actually incorporates, brings into it the experiences of women, and particularly of women's oppression. That's what being a feminist means.
Is that the dangerous memory? Is it the memory of women's oppression? Or the memory of her?
Well, I think there's two really important things in dangerous memories. So the question is, who are they dangerous to? One of the things that feminism has constantly worked on teasing out in various areas, of which theology is obviously only one, is the things that women know that are dangerous to the establishment, that is, dangerous to out there, and the things that we know that are dangerous to us. I mean, I think the sort of nearest comparison, although it is not a comparison, it is only an analogy, would be that which is contained, for example, in Negro spirituals, which are both the songs of slavery and the signs of freedom simultaneously. The hope it's called in Christian terms. So I think we have to be very tentative about danger. I mean, one of the dangerous memories is they burnt witches. It is dangerous for women to walk too near the dark side. I think it has been, and whether or not one wants to remember that, it is a dangerous memory. It is also, I think, as people like Fiorenza, Elizabeth Schuster Fiorenza, for example, and other feminist theologians of the last 10 years, Rosemary Ruther, Daphne Hampson, I'll give you a long list, Grace Jansen in England, Angela West, you know, have been uncovering both as philosophic research and as historic research. There is a lot in the tradition which is dangerous to the holders of power, that beginning from the very beginning, with Mary Magdalene being the first person to be invited to proclaim the resurrection, and her very rapid silencing only two chapters later when the male disciples think that it's just women's gossip. So I think, I mean, when one explores dangerous memories, one's exploring both ways to give oneself courage and also ways to contest injustice. And I would like to put all of that very theoretical sounding stuff in the context of the sort of stuff that was being named at the Beijing conference. And indeed, in my paper that I'm giving at the Dangerous Memory Conference, the bulk of it is taken up with a very careful reading of the Sarah and Abraham story to try and raise some of the issues around women's lives from there, where Sarah is in terms of the storyteller, definitely kind of support role only. And yet there is read, if you can try and have a reading of the text where she is the central character, you get a very different story. And I think that that's quite interesting. I think it's very interesting, actually. I think it's riveting. I mean, one of the bits that is continually left out in the popular preaching of that story, Abraham takes Isaac up the mountain, prepares to kill him, doesn't do so, comes back again. Sarah moves out. She never speaks to Abraham. She sets up a separate encampment. Women do not have to put up, if we're going to model ourselves on that particular ethic, do not have to put up with the abuse of their children. She moves up and sets up another tent. He stays in Beersheba and she goes up to Hebron and lives there until she dies. And they have no further conversations. And now that's very undercover in the sense. It's not pressed home on the reader, but it's absolutely there. That's not me making it up. And so it's not just looking at the story, it's looking at the way the story has been used.
When J.B. Metz refers in a, by now, quite famous phrase to Christian belief as depending entirely on a dangerous memory, what do you understand him referring to by that phrase, dangerous memory?
Well, I think it simply says that Christian religion, to use that word, but Christianity, the Christian way, goes back to the molten core of the Jewish Christian revelation. In other words, to the business of Exodus. And whether you're Jew or Christian, this is where you both begin and end. Because what the Bible talks about at its molten core, at that point of luminous simplicity where all the complexity somehow falls away, is the God who, against all the odds, sets slaves free. And that, if there's a dangerous memory, that's again where it begins and where it ends. What you have in the Bible is a tremendous metaphor. In other words, Egypt is everywhere. Pharaoh lurks around every corner. Every human being, in that sense, is a slave. So basically, the Bible is nothing other than a memory of a liberation which happened once and which is available to us now. Now, in the Christian understanding, that liberation comes to its point of fullness only once a man comes through the darkness of death into a newness of life. In other words, a liberation even from the Egypt of death, even from that kind of ultimate hopelessness, a hope is born. That again is what the Bible, whether it be the Jewish Bible or the Christian Bible, is talking about, a hope that is born always and only out of hopelessness. Now, therefore, the hope that the Bible talks about and that is the very essence of this dangerous memory is not cheap or cosmetic.
Mark Coleridge, who teaches Scripture at Catholic Theological College in Melbourne.
Yes, but what is liberated here in the modern scheme of things is the individual, who now has the freedom to renounce the claims of the collective. That's why the story, my story of Jewish responses to catastrophe begins with the Book of Lamentations, and in particular the third chapter, where within the chorus of dirges and lamenters, suddenly you hear the voice of the lone survivor. And he is alone in anguish. He feels trapped and abandoned by God. And what you hear is loud and clear, that voice of rage and loss calling out to us across the millennia. So that's the, I suppose, the apocalyptic moment. It is liberation, but it's not a positive liberation. It's a terrifying moment of freedom because you sense the absence of God, the absence of any kind of covenantal relationship. What you're facing is the abyss. In the case of that particular survivor, the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem, which was the seat of the sacrificial cult. That was the main conduit, after all, that Israel had to God, and that was now destroyed and defiled. But the way that the survivor expresses his sense of loss is by taking the biblical text and turning it on its head, doing violence to the text, or doing unto the text that which the enemy has done to us. So what I think happens there is he takes the 22nd Psalm, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want," and he says, "I am the rod of his wrath." God has taken his shepherd's rod and he has smitten me with it, which is an extraordinary inversion of the psalm and the psalmist. It's almost an act of sacrilege. It's certainly an act of violence against the text. And that, to me, is the key moment, because on the one hand, what is being expressed here is the moment of break, of loss of faith. But because the expression, the form that that protest takes, is to channel it back into the most sacred text itself, it opens the text up to the catastrophe and to the historical experience as well, so that it's impossible after that to read the 22nd Psalm and not to think of the Book of Lamentations, and not to think of that lone survivor doing violence to the text. It expands the meaning of the sacred text and allows for the moment of breakage, of violation, of anger, of sacrilege, so that this is the way these, well, dangerous memories, I suppose you could say, become absorbed into the traditional idiom itself. And that, I think, is really the beauty of a religious tradition, that it is not inviolable, because it has to allow, there has to be a give and take, you know, within any religious tradition. It has to make room for those moments of crisis and of catastrophe. And God knows the Jews have had enough of those.
David Roskies, speaking here about his book Against the Apocalypse. His new book, published this year, is A Bridge of Longing, The Lost Art of Yiddish Storytelling. What story got to do with dangerous memories? There's a saying, I think it's Jewish, that God made us because he loves stories.
It's not just that God loves stories, God is stories. At least we have no other way of conceiving God. I mean, if you ask me, what is God other than a story? I just don't know. I don't, and if I knew, I wouldn't have words to put to it. The only words I have to put to God happen to be a story. So in that sense, you could say what the rabbis are claiming is that God created us because God loved himself. I mean, you can talk about God as being the supreme being and all of that stuff, you know, the good, the true and the beautiful, all taken to some extreme. But frankly, all of that strikes me as slightly bloodless. Again, I come back to the biblical perception, and it's fundamental, the God who names himself in action. Now, once you're dealing with that, you're not dealing with abstractions, and God save us from them, as the Bible would insist. You are dealing with a God who can only be recounted. To encounter God, you have to recount God.
It's so early yet to assess what's going on, but I'd take a guess that we're at a very delicate point, that in one sense we had a language and it's been turned into dogmas. So the official religious discourse is largely useless because it's lost contact with its own earlier levels of story.
I think that's absolutely right. I think that if we look at the biblical texts, there's extraordinary little abstraction in the Bible. It is stories. It's also poems and letters and sayings and other things. But predominantly it is simply stories. And it seems to me that what Western theology has done is this abstracting, sucking out, trying to suck out some philosophical content from story and discard the context, to put it in a modern, more modern language. And yes, I think that we have theology has lost contact with that narrative base. And it's also lost contact, I think, with the stories of our own lives, which is why theology can talk about ethics in ways that are palpably nonsense, you know? The story that we need to start with is the story of my own life. I am the self who owns a story, as Rowan Williams, the Bishop of Monmouth, has a really nice phrase when he says, the self is what the past is doing now. You know, if I do not claim my own story, and of course my story as a Western woman is also partly the biblical story.
It's crucial for dangerous memory because the biblical story, the story of God moving in the arena of time. So God is bounced onto the stage at the start of the biblical story without a name. In fact, he's given the ridiculous non-name Elohim, all the more ridiculous because it's plural, when the Bible defends nothing more passionately than the oneness of God. Then in Exodus chapter 3, when Moses very reasonably asks God his name, says, just before you go, excuse God of the burning bush, tell me your name so that when I go to Pharaoh with this marvellous commission, I can say which God sent me. The answer that Moses gets is, you go and tell them that I am sent you, which is not much of a help. In other words, the God of this biblical story is addicted to anonymity. Why? Because the God of this story says, if you want to know who I am, and there is no task more important in human life, then you look at what I do. Therefore, the story is the naming of God. Where does it begin? It begins with the darkness, the emptiness, and the chaos. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep. In the darkness of things, the emptiness of things, the chaos of things, the seeming hopelessness of things, the nothingness of things, this is precisely where the story of God begins. And many people can't see the story of God either in the world or in their own life because they look in the wrong place. They don't look in the darkness, the emptiness and the chaos because they say God can't be there. But in fact, according to the biblical story, God's only there. That's the dangerous memory. As the story unfolds, we're told the Spirit of God, in fact a better translation is the breath of God, moves over the face of the waters of chaos. So what do we hear in the Bible? The first sound is simply... Something's heard in the darkness. There's a presence there. Is it for good or for ill? This is the question. Then we hear in the story, God said... In other words, the divine breath hits the divine vocal cords, and out comes the single word light. In English, let there be light. And there was light. What does the word, the story, do? It brings light out of darkness, even though that seemed impossible. It brings fullness out of emptiness, and it brings order out of chaos. That action, the first action God performs, the first naming of God in this great story, is the archetypal naming. That's what God does. That's what the story's about.
Australia remembers. Georgina Williams remembers. She's attempting to resurrect her dreaming place, to retain her past, and to pass it on to Aboriginal children.
My attempt was for us not to lose ourselves, because if we lose ourselves, when we look in the mirror, who do we see? We can't see ourselves.
How did you go about this, though? Where did you start to reclaim this heritage?
Well, it all happened accidentally and through the deepest trauma of my own experience of being left alone. When the old people died, I was really lonely, all alone and in despair.
Were you the last of your people?
Well, there are other children taught like me, but not everyone took it in to the same extent, I think, is how you put it. But the influence of the old ones and the old world and the old life that was lived before the occupation of our lands by the invasionary peoples was indelibly imprinted into myself. And I found it difficult to know who I was. I came to a point in my life where, who am I? I'm coffee-coloured, my eyes are blue. Who am I? I had no white life things in my life other than that which the missionaries taught us. And that was about the Christian faith and God and how to live in a Christian family life, encapsulated in time on a mission reserve where the last of our people was gathered up and placed after the first invasion. And the effects of the first invasion was to kill off us, the plant life, and the animal life.
Because your people traditionally lived in and about what we call Adelaide.
Yeah. Adelaide City itself is in the middle of the Federation of Jilbrookie, and that's the Kaurna people. And the Kaurna people are named by various subgroups, as they're called, or tribes, as white people call us, but self-named by the location of the song. The song places you in a position where you're a caretaker for, or like you live in an estate, if you like. But within that, you're not confined into only that small space. So 40 miles from Adelaide to the south, 60 miles the other way, and from the hill line to the coast, which is about 25 miles. So that's the country.
That's Georgina Williams's country. She once described this remembering and handing on of a tradition as a dreaming back the dreaming of the old song, a walking over the song.
About 3 years ago, I did a workshop with Jim Berg, who's the chairman of the Koori Heritage Trust. And the Koori Heritage Trust has set up a permanent exhibition at the State Museum in Swanson Street, which tells the story of Aboriginal history in Victoria from a Koori perspective, from an Aboriginal perspective. And here I joined him on a workshop where he took us around the exhibits of this exhibition. And I came to a map. Now, I was staring at this map. Instantaneously, I remembered another map. This other map was in Treblinka. At the outskirts of Treblinka, there was a pavilion. Now, Treblinka is now a clearing in a forest, a beautiful forest, a pine forest. It's unbelievable to think that 850,000 or whatever people were murdered in this forest. In the pavilion, there is a map. It's called a map of execution, a massacre map. And it shows all the sites of execution all over Poland. And there are hundreds and thousands of them. The land is littered with memories of battles and skirmishes and the dead and the fallen and clearings in forests. You'll find them everywhere. It's extraordinary. What was the map I was looking at the State Museum? A map of Victoria. It was called the Massacre Map. The dates were, I think from memory, a 15, 16-year stretch between 1835 and 1851, I think. And there were 63 sites of execution. The numbers were between, what, 3 or 4 to 50, 60 in each separate massacre. Now, I thought to myself, how is it that it's taken me so long to see such a map? How come such a map was not in front of me going through the school system? 12 years of schooling, 4 years of an arts honours degree in history, mind you, in political science, and never once did I hear the word Wurundjeri, and never once did I get an inkling that this was part of the past. And so, to me, there's very clear-cut connections. That's on the negative side. On the positive side, when I talk to Joy Murphy, you know, to Wurundjeri elder, I know what her excitement is all about when she says, "Ah, oh, Arnold, I've just gotten another story, Barak story." Now, Barak was her great uncle who was one of the last headmen of the Wurundjeri people, who was a magnificent storyteller, apparently, at the turn of this century. And she's retrieving some of the stories, and she's hoping to write a book of those stories that her great uncle told. And I know her sense of excitement when she finds out, "Oh, I heard another story." You know, she's retrieving the past, and it's giving her a deeper sense of her identity. And on another level, she is making her contribution to this collective past of which we are all a part as Australians in the 1990s. So there are very much connections. And I think we did connect. It's interesting that when I first met Joy, I gave her a copy of Jewels and Ashes, and she related to it immediately.
Arnold Zabel. His book Jewels and Ashes is a recreation of his parents' city of Bialystok. It's on the border of Poland and Belarus. It's the fabled sinister city of his childhood in Melbourne. Writing about the vanished world of his family has enabled Arnold Zabel to understand something of the experience of Aboriginal peoples. The Wurundjeri, for instance, whose land lies between the sea and the mountains, centred on where Melbourne now stands. Catastrophe. However do people live with it?
In my prior book on Jewish responses to catastrophe, I actually turn the argument around. And I look at those parts of Jewish culture that seem on the surface to be very angry, apocalyptic, where God is being challenged, the God of history is renounced, the traditional theology of sin and retribution is negated, works of rage, of railing against God and Jewish history. I take a look at that, and what I discover is that this is not something born in the Holocaust. It is not a moment of profound break in Jewish faith and sensibility that you can say comes out of the experience of the Second World War. But on the contrary, this is a very traditional form of Jewish response to catastrophe, going back to the beginning of recorded time. I try to trace it, in fact, back to the Bible itself and to the destruction of the first temple, Solomon's temple. And I try to demonstrate how this anger at God and how the breaking of the tablets, if you will, is a process that each generation goes through anew. The difference is that in the 19th and 20th century, the actors in the drama change. Up until the 19th century, normally responses that are the province of the cultural, of the rabbinic elite. It's a function of rabbinic culture. In other words, mainstream normative Judaism allows for these outbursts of anger, for these counter commentaries, taking the biblical text and turning it on its head in the face of a pogrom, of an act of destruction, of the Crusades, or what have you. Come the 19th century and the 20th century, what happens is this, that the chief architects of this are now secular writers and poets. So they, in a sense, take over the job of the rabbis. And the other thing that happens is that they renounce the traditional theology. They no longer accept the basic premise of biblical and rabbinic Judaism, namely that whatever ill befalls the Jews happens because it is the hand of God. It is an act in the covenantal drama. They renounce this basic theological idea, and then they have to come up with something else, some other scheme to explain historical events. Or if they can't do that, then simply to emit the great scream of protest and to claim that really there is no meaning to all of this. But what happens is that even the apocalyptic anger becomes a link in the chain of Jewish responses. And even, and this is the crux of my argument, even the destruction of European Jewry in the Second World War takes its place in that chain of catastrophes.
When I first went to the Melbourne Town Hall in the 1950s, I was just a kid, 5, 6, 7 years old. My parents and their generation would spend the whole year getting on with life, rebuilding their lives, basically from scratch, from nothing. But it reserved this one day of the year called Yom HaShoah. We're talking about Australia Remembers, the day of the year, Anzac Days, Armistice Days. Well, for them it was April the 19th or thereabouts when the community gathered in the town hall and then they gave vent to their communal grief. That's what they were doing. The whole hall would be weeping, 5,000 strong or whatever it was, that crammed into the Melbourne Town Hall.
They shall grow not old, as we that are left grow old. Age shall not weary them, nor the years condemn. At the going down of the sun, and in the morning, we will remember them.
We will remember them.
The religious experience, the spiritual experience in our time is a waiting for God. God does not reveal himself in an authoritative manner through the dogma of the church as proclaimed. God does not reveal himself as the origin of nature as he did for Aquinas. God seems to reveal himself in traces and in blanks and in gaps for us, and we have to piece that together.
The past became real to me there. When I walked the streets that my parents and my ancestors had walked for centuries, it was real. It was no longer a city of the mind. It was something much more concrete than that. I saw with my own eyes the past. And it's interesting because the area, to my surprise, where my mother had grown up, an area called the Chanaikas in Bialystok, it's very much a working class, even lumpen proletariat type area. It's still there intact because it was outside the ghetto walls. I could actually see what she had described to me as a child. Now, at that level, you know it's not a game. You see, when you see that, you know it's not a game, that there's flesh and blood and suffering and joy and a whole lot of things that somehow are still hovering about there that you can tap into. It was an extraordinary experience. To some extent, it can never be taken away from me. It's become so much a part of me, especially since when I came back to Australia, I sat down then and went on another journey to write the book, to put all these bits and pieces together, the journey plus the fragments of the past plus fragments of history, to write the rise and fall of the city of Bialystok and to interweave with that the story of my ancestors, and then all the time the voice of the narrator, which is the second generation person, myself, going on that journey back to the old world. I still think you can come back to a sense of wholeness.
Arnold Zabel on putting the pieces, the fragments of our lives, together.
The biblical storytellers very consciously and deliberately build into their story gaps. So to make sense of this gapped story that is fraught with ambiguities and opacities is to make sense of the world as it is. Therefore, to read this story well becomes almost a rehearsal for life in the world. So between biblical story and the real world, there is an essential continuum. This is crucial to the ideology of biblical story and its technique of biblical storytelling. The biblical storyteller realizes that the world is full of gaps and disjunctions and opacities and ambiguities. These are built into the story. I mean, the great story of David and Bathsheba comes to mind because it's a parade example of what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I like the art historian's image of the kind of paint, the brush marks of particular artists. I think what we're seeing, we can't see the whole picture, we can see the brush marks of the divine artist. Or, on other days, the smudges. I think that's right. I suppose a bit of me feels that maybe God's given up on direct revelation, given how much he dished out and how little it was noticed. I rather like the idea that God is really deeply into crossword puzzles and lays down cryptic clues, as it were.
That strikes me as being almost an image of the Bible,
yeah,
and women in the Bible. Traces, gaps, blanks, crossword puzzles. The women are there in the gaps.
Well, I think, yeah, and Fiorenza has taught us, I think, how to read the silences. And Phyllis Trible, for example, and lots of other people are filling in those silences. But, yeah, the central point, I think, that I would want to make is there is no text of a people that does not incorporate slightly more than 50% of the people are going to be women. That is how it is. So that any story about a people is a story about women. What one's looking at is the story of how they've got hidden, how they've got marginalised, how they've been pushed into the silences, but the suggestion that they're not there is self-denying. Self-denying on the part of women. I think people get very easily scared by absence.
In difficult times, mystics often keep alive the dangerous memory of desire's liberation, of an unbounded love.
So in a sense, it's a book of continuities, Jewels and Ashes, rather than accentuating the discontinuities.
Well, yes and no. I think it's a little bit more complex than that. For example, you may have noticed how I end the book, that I don't take the easy way out. It's not a rising crescendo to the Jewish identity is going to continue. Now, it's a very quiet ending. It goes back to my mother, back to my father. For example, my father and I having a discussion where my father is eulogising the power of words and the power of the past to a certain extent and the power of memory. But then at a certain point, he stops, he falters, and tears come to his eyes. And in that moment, we both sensed that which can't be grasped by words, something that that escapes past and future. And just that moment when he glimpsed that he himself would die, he was coming towards death. And he said, yes, he said, because we always used to have a kind of a discussion that there's something that goes beyond memory, something called silence. And in that silence, in a sense, you are firmly rooted in the present, and it can be quite frightening. And I think that that moment is when you see that on one level, all of this is just a game. All our constructs on one level is just a game that gets obliterated by something which we call the eternal present or eternity. Now, this was just within a year or two before my father died when we had this. And actually, the next day he was going to have an operation. I think that was partly what led to that moment. And I said to him, well, why did you cry? And he says, well, you know, I had tears and I felt sad because in that moment, I glimpsed that which cannot be put into words. And yet I was also happy because I know that my words have been understood and I've conveyed them to you and I've been responded to. So, you know, it was a very, very complex moment. So what I'm getting at is that at one level, there is something that goes way beyond the past. And maybe this is dangerous. This is perhaps the great danger. And yet, it's a danger I cannot avoid because I've experienced it.
When I asked Arnold Zabel, how do you tell stories about that? He spoke of his love for the Hasidic stories, the way they did it. In Islam too, the Sufis tell stories. Here's how the Hasidic mystical tradition transformed David Roski's life.
The book on storytelling, to be very honest, was born out of personal experience and is really profoundly autobiographical. I only allude to that in the published version because my editor thought it was a little too self-indulgent, and whatever my editor says is what I do. But in fact, in the late 60s, I too, all my contemporaries, was in rebellion against my parents and rebellion against the establishment. We were all students at the time, the war in Vietnam and all of that. But I just happened to be in the right place at the right time and fell in with a group of young Jews who created a religious neo-Hasidic commune in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and were able to channel their rebellion into a kind of a reimagined Eastern European Jewish past. And so we began to pray in a certain way, and we taught ourselves contemplative melodies. We learned them from records. We started studying these mystical texts together. Now it was men and women together. In the old days, of course, women never went near this stuff. All right, so we adapted it to a kind of whole earth and countercultural American lifestyle, but we created a new image of the Jewish past. It was very selective. But I think the important message that I'm trying to get across is that even though these are acts of invention and camouflage. I think that when it works, it really works, that the new tradition that evolves is existentially compelling and has its own source of authenticity. I speak from my own experience. It worked for me, and it transformed my own life.
David Roskies is fascinated by the uses we make of the past, of how we discover a usable past, or how we reimagine the past. In a provocative phrase, he describes the Yiddish storyteller's relationship to Jewish tradition as one of creative betrayal.
What happens is they decide that they want to salvage a piece of the past and recreate it. So that's the creative part. But given that these are modern people with very sophisticated sensibilities, the only way they can retrieve pieces of their past is by betraying it in the name of modernity, in the name of the new values that they have absorbed. And so they create something that never existed before, a new kind of synthesis. The reason I like creative betrayal so much is that it's an oxymoron. I think that's how you pronounce it. A yoking together of two opposites.
In the ongoing task of interpretation, that which is the reading of the story, the appropriation of the story, making it our own in this time and this place, there is always an element of betrayal in the sense that we say that other readings from earlier times, however noble and enriching and powerful they might be, are not our reading. We must make another reading of our own. And in that sense, because it's other, our reading is a betrayal of the past, but it's a very creative betrayal in that sense. So I think the element of appropriation of the text, I mean, you talk about Salman Rushdie, what he's talking about is the Quran. What he has mounted, he would claim, others would disagree, of course, is a creative betrayal of the text. Feminist scholars claim the same. Now, these claims need to be pressed because there are creative and uncreative betrayals.
Thinking of Dangerous Memory, would creative betrayal relate in some sense to that dangerous memory?
Yes, and I mean, I think perhaps that's precisely what the feminist task is.
It's a very, very powerful word.
I mean, it's dangerous because it leads to things like crucifixions, but it's also dangerous because nothing in the world hurts like betrayal hurts. I think it's to be betrayed is, I do not know, even the small experiences that I've had of it are devastating. So that I think one has to be very clear if one's going to go around doing it, that it is creative and that one is prepared to stand by with the creative process. I think I would go for the word prophet rather than the word mystic, although I think the two are very closely related. And that it's very important to remember that Christ is both prophet and priest. Priests tend to have stopped being prophets, which is probably more comfortable for us, but perhaps not right. Augustine of Hippo says somewhere that hope has two lovely daughters, courage and anger. And it seems to me that the hopeful, in the serious, real gospel sense of that word, are the people who keep it enkindled. And whether they do that the way that mystics do, which is by moving slightly outside the normal time-space continuum, or whether they do it as good prophets do, by very precisely moving in there and discerning very precisely the signs of the times, the moments of the present, it doesn't seem to me to matter. The important thing is that brewing up of hope. Hope is the belief, I think, that things don't have to stay the same. Don't have to trickle downwards, that entropy doesn't in fact have to win. I think where hope is, yeah, enormous courage follows, but courage without hope is very nihilistic, just as anger without hope is very destructive. So somehow mystic is one word for it, prophet is another. I think the poet is also a word for that, and perhaps an easier one. The word poet originally in the Greek just means a maker, somebody who makes things, creative. And we do not look after our mystics, prophets or poets very well, as a matter of fact. But that doesn't mean that we don't need them. I think we kind of need them crucially.
So we've returned to hope and to joy. The joy of some of these prophets, mystics and poets can be a dangerous memory.
It's by no means coincidental that all the great songs of liberation in the Bible are placed on the lips of women. I mean, here is one of the great and majestic points at which you see how radically and mysteriously countercultural the Bible is.
Which songs are these?
The Song of Miriam, which is perhaps the oldest text we have in the whole Bible, in the book of Exodus, Miriam being the sister of Moses. The Song of Judith, the Song of Mary, and so on. You've got to look at why women exercise at times, I won't say at every point, but at certain points, a quite countercultural role, or at least a role that was in no way typical of the surrounding cultures. And this is because, again, you're dealing with a story that talks about slaves set free, but the slave becomes a metaphor. So too then does the woman. So does the widow, the orphan and the stranger, that great mystic triad, the true heroes of Scripture. Why does the Bible focus upon the widow, the stranger and the orphan? Because these were the most vulnerable, marginal people. There are, of course, patriarchal traces, but it's undeniable that there are, at vital moments, Mary Magdalene comes to mind. She who is the prime witness of the resurrection. There is no question about that. Dangerous memory is always a very complex thing.
In Dangerous Memories, you heard from Mark Coleridge, who teaches Scripture at Catholic Theological College in Melbourne. He's the author of The Birth of the Lucan Narrative. David Roskies, whose most recent book is A Bridge of Longing, The Lost Art of Yiddish Storytelling. It's in the shops now. His earlier book was Against the Apocalypse, Jewish Responses to Catastrophe. Georgina Williams, who's a community worker. Arnold Zabel, the author of Jewels and Ashes. And Sarah Maitland, feminist, novelist and theologian. Her recent books include A Big Enough God, Artful Theology, a novel, Three Times Table, and a book of stories, Women Fly When Men Aren't Watching. Technical production, Nick Mirisch. I'm Damien Coleridge. Encounter is 30 years old this year, and next week there's a special program to celebrate the event. Namarakishu, namarakishu, namarakishu. Oh!